And I understand that they are thinking of actually engraving these missing 33,000 names on a memorial, either in Iraq after the war or possibly even in the UK. And he concludes, to my mind, particularly egregiously, by saying that I can assure you that equality in terms of race and creed are most certainly in the forefront of what we seek to do. By way of illustration, I am enclosing a recent educational CD, Let Us Die Like Brothers, which does deal openly with some of the issues. And this Let Us Die Like Brothers is an educational program that they've made about the fate of the South African natives who drowned on the Mendi, which, as you may know, sank with the loss of 600 lives or so in the English Channel of African Labour Corps people. And they, what's interesting about it is they've redone, because these African Labour Corps people died in Europe, they actually, their names appear on memorials in on the South Coast, actually. And so they've made a whole sort of self-congratulatory thing about how egalitarian they are, without bothering to tell anybody that had the ship sunk, you know, nearer to South Africa where it left, and not so near to the channel where this happened, they would have no record at all of those names. So that's me finished. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very, very rich and thought-provoking paper that I think will raise lots of questions. But if I may, I will start off, actually.
Yes.
I've been recently doing quite a lot of work, actually, on Indian soldiers mm-hmm. in the Second World War.
Right.
And there again, I mean, it's, I guess, a little bit more difficult because a lot of the decommissioning papers haven't actually been released. They're still with the Ministry of Defence. And what has constantly been coming up, really, in the records that I've been looking at, is this question of memorialization, in particular in relation to the Indian Army, where you find a lot of talk of them collectively, but not individually. And in terms of memorialization and commemoration, again, in the huge cemeteries where you would rather have a monument and not necessarily the individual names. For that, you know, the Victoria Cross files, for example, would be much more useful. And what I found was very interesting was actually that there seems to be a shift in policy in the Imperial War the Imperial War Graves Commission, now the Commonwealth War Graves mm-hmm. Commission, almost wanting to get back to the kind of policy that they set out at the beginning, trying to actually commemorate everyone equally. And I wonder in how far you think that trend is connected to actually Britain becoming aware of its own cultural diversity and actually a feeling of needing to reclaim that these names, bringing them back into a common shared history of both world wars.
Mm. Well, that is interesting. I mean, I tend to feel that if you look at the early documents of the Imperial War Graves Commission, they never talk about equality of race and creed. They talk about equality of military rank and civil rank. And I think it's been retrospectively imposed upon it. And it seems to me that, you know, one of the reasons why that happened was because those principles, possibly hard for people to see now just how very controversial they were. They were incredibly controversial, and they were in danger of being defeated by all the people who, for instance, thought that if you had the money, you ought to be able to bring your son's body home, and the people who felt that it was absolutely terrible that commemoration was not taking the form of the Christian cross, but was these blank headstones. And so they were in a certain amount of trouble trying to get this through. And there was a debate in Parliament, which was actually won, as far as I can see, rhetorically, by an appeal to the empire and the unity and brotherhood of people across the empire. And of course, you know, when we look at that now, we wouldn't think that is likely to generate equality of race and creed. But somehow it's been retrospectively imposed on the commission in its early years. I'd be probably a bit more sceptical about it than that, because I think that's, I don't know about the Second World War, I would have thought that's quite a recent thing. I mean, I certainly think that, you know, obviously as the guy says in his letter, they decided to have a major review in the early 90s of it, when they became aware of it. But my sort of increasing feeling about them is that if they had any genuine desire of that kind, they might be willing to ever concede that they were in the wrong about any of these things. Yes. Whereas in fact they, well, not in the wrong, but in the wrong in terms of what their policy now is. But actually what they do is they go to very great lengths to, that's why I said finding that picture of, you know, I began to think I was going mad, you know, because I knew from the paperwork that they had done that in Basra, but it was so difficult to get any sort of visual evidence of it. And the War Graves Commission themselves will print out lists of casualties in which they itemize individually the Indian Army casualties, and they say panel 52 of the Basra Memorial, as if their name was on it, when in fact what they're referring to is a thing that says and 149 other Indian soldiers. And so they go to pretty great lengths to make it difficult for people to find what they did do. And I think they're much more concerned about sort of preserving the appearance of being egalitarian now than they are about sort of being open about it. Mm. So
it's some more collective memory rather than
remembering
individuals.
Mm.
Any other questions? Shamita.
So were there any lobbies from Indian Voices about, was there any even kind of any dialogue with the Indian Army or Indian, you know, Indian people about the memorials and the War Commission? Was the Imperial War Commission just kind of very, I presume, London-based kind of internal dialogue?
Well, no, actually they did have a lot of dialogue. Had certainly had a lot of dialogue with the India office in London and a lot of dialogue with the Indian Army headquarters. And, I mean, I think that, I don't think it was out of the question that all the names of the Indian Army other ranks would be engraved on that memorial. And my understanding is that they didn't think it was ideal, but they thought it was what they would have to do, and they also wanted, Nadia might be able to tell us more about it, they wanted to get the memorial safely up before the expiration of the mandate, and so they wanted to sort of get it up and not kind of have the British leave and leave it sort of unfinished, and they decided to do it this way. But in other places, for instance at Gallipoli, they sort of suddenly realised when they designed all the Heller's Memorial that they sort of had room to put the Indian names up, and they did in fact put them up. So they're a bit inconsistent about it. I mean, the point that I was generally trying to make is if you think this is one thing, sort of try looking at what they did in Africa, because actually everywhere they do treat the Indian Army with much more respect.
I'm just saying, there's no dialogue with India about
people of ethnic Indian descent.
Or, you know, what, subsequently? Or in the interwar period?
Well, I know of. I mean, I'm quite interested. I've only just stumbled across this thing about the reversal of the names, because I think, well, haven't people complained to them that they've had terrible trouble trying to find their grandfather? And, you know, I'd be interested to find out about that.
Okay. they keep that kind of correspondence?
I think they do, actually. I mean, one thing I'm... You know, when I wrote to this guy, I asked him if he'd, you know, let us do some research. I mean, I have done, you know, I had a small British Academy grant, and Tracy Loughran and I did some work in these archives. And but I was very much sort of, you know, ooh, can I get a photocopy of that page and this page and the other page? And it was slightly, they certainly weren't very forthcoming about any of it. You know, you could say, can I look at the file for Tanganyika or something, and they would produce it, but they're not very keen to open their archives for this kind of scrutiny, which means actually you can't do a proper, you know, if you haven't got proper access to the files. I mean, I did have some access, but not total. I mean, the one that I'd really like is to look at the personal file of Lord Arthur Brown, who was... You know, he is such a big figure in making their policy, and his cultural preferences seem so stamped all over what they did. So I can't find out much about him. But I get the impression that, you know, they take very seriously queries from the public. I think if people wrote in with queries like that, they might keep them, but they certainly would try to answer them, and you could talk to commission staff about them.
I wonder if you had the opportunity to look at any of the history before the foundation of the Imperial War Graves Commission. Do they keep any material of what was going on before? I asked this because I was very struck by the exhibition last year at Flanders Fields, the Land Culture War Exhibition, yeah, which people may have seen, and the way in which that highlighted the German propaganda campaign aimed at the Indian Army, and particularly at Muslim soldiers, particularly attacking the British for not treating burial and commemoration in a proper and respectful manner, and the reaction to that in the setting up of the Woking Muslim burial ground, which was previous to the actual institution of the Imperial War Graves Commission. Can we get any access to any of the thinking or the British side of that from any archival source?
Well, I mean, I was interested that the policy in East Africa, which as far as I can see set the model for Africa as a whole, was more or less laid down by somebody who was asked to sort of take a view on it before, and that was during the war and before the founding of the Imperial War Graves Commission. And he was, I'm just trying to remember, he was called George Evans, and he was, I think somebody from the Graves Registration Unit wrote to him and said, could you tell us what you think should happen? And he was pretty extreme, actually, and he said, you know, these people are savages, and they put their dead out for hyenas to eat them, and, you know, it's a total waste of money, and people who are buried in the bush should just be left there to revert to nature, and, you know, okay, maybe put up a statue here and there if you really think it's necessary. So he took a very strong position, and quite a lot of the position that he took finds its way into the, you know, sort of official policy documents. But I don't know, in a word. I mean, I would imagine that... I mean, but basically this project has sort of got a bit out of hand, and I haven't really done it properly. I keep thinking I must go to various other archives and see what I can find, you know, that might corroborate some of these arguments. But basically I have just been looking at what's in the War Graves Commission's own archives. But that is interesting. So did you go to the Five Continents in Flanders?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was absolutely fascinating, wasn't it? Yeah.
Please.
A couple of things. I was wondering about the
Yeah.
Where it is more likely to go, and not in Mesopotamia or Egypt. And Egypt, I mean, first of all, the first thing that kind of comes to mind is surely they're closer, more likely to go. But in the case of Mesopotamia specifically, it was seen very much during the war as a place for Indian migration, large scale Indian migration that would sort out the problems of Mesopotamia. So it just struck me as interesting that nobody would ever see it, so it didn't matter. But actually, in the minds of people as the war was being fought, that wasn't how they saw it. So I just kind of thought that was interesting. And also, just really, I guess I was quite struck by the difference between the way that they kind of treated the soldiers in Mesopotamia compared to, very specifically, with the press coverage during the War of the campaign, which highlighted, really strongly, the loyalty of the Indian soldiers and how important that was, and how India was, being fantastic and amazing. Look at these sepoys and, showing Indian loyalty, and there was the empire all together. And it was just the public nature of that photograph of the sepoys, the kind of little character sketches of this particular sepoy in Mesopotamia, as opposed to them having them, and 164 others. So I just those two things, I guess, kind of what you were saying, that it would be interesting to see, to compare the wartime kind of opinions if they've been handled with what happens afterwards, and I guess to see how the people who are saying them, interestingly, as you were saying about his interests, he's so much more sympathetic than the Indians. And it's interesting to see that, to see whether people with different expertise in different areas just saw things differently. Do you know what I mean? People were more human rather than types, as you described, depending on whether you'd have lived or served.
Yeah. I mean, I agree on the second point. On the first point, I think it is really interesting that they... it does figure very largely that this business of will any relative travel, but also it is a matter of... I read some of the correspondence going to and fro about different cemeteries in Mesopotamia, and they're sort of saying, lots of people travel through Baghdad or Basra, and it's really important for the sort of British image that these are tickety-boo, sort of, we've got to make sure they're in good condition and so forth. So it is sort of partly a question about British reputation and prestige, possibly, if they maintain them properly. So I think that is quite important. But of course, looking at it now, I think it's so interesting because they just assumed, even with Neuve Chapelle on the Western Front, they assumed that this was a good thing to do to show how seriously they respected the contribution of the Indian Army. But the King himself, made this very pompous pronouncement in which he spoke to the peoples of India and said, I know you will never, ever be able to come here. And so, aren't we great commemorating your folks, because you'll never be able to see it. And then you look at the visitors book and it's just full of all these people who've come from India. So the fact that, travel has changed so dramatically from then to now does make it, I think, quite difficult to get into the way in which they thought about those issues then. They really did think it was completely impossible. Whereas now, of course, we know, which is why I think it's so extraordinary the War Graves Commission can't get their database right, that, there must be lots of... can I just say, if anybody thinks I'm wrong in that interpretation, I'd be really interested to hear, but it just looks to me as if they can't get it right, and that does mean that they're probably are a lot of people wanting to investigate that. But I'm interested in your opening question, because I was thinking of, do you know Nirmal Poor? She was involved with an installation of an Indian soldier who'd fought in the Second World War. And there's a picture of him.
Oh, Rosina told me.
Have you seen it? With his turban and his uniform on. And it was just made into an art object.
Yeah.
And they, some town hall, you know, like Birmingham City Council or something, said they couldn't display it because it was too controversial and it was sort of political, you know. And in fact, it ended up in sort of Goldsmiths in Deptford Town Hall as being the people who were, you know, willing to display this contentious image. Yeah. And it was just about, look, he's Indian and he's a soldier.
Yeah, he's a soldier and he's in that uniform. And I mean, the part of the problem, I guess, with the Second World War is that nobody feels responsible. The Indian government has forgotten the Indian army or those who fought with the British at the time. They sort of washed their hands of them, saying this wasn't our war. Mm. And the British seem to have forgotten them as well. I mean, it's in a way ironic that members of the Indian National Army get a freedom fighter's pension, but soldiers who fought in the Second World War don't get a pension, get a veteran's pension at all. There are still a lot of Second World War veterans living in the UK. They don't get invited to the commemorations, the official commemorations. They have certain generals or the children of generals or soldiers who served under these Indian soldiers who will make sure that they will get invited to some functions at the MOD puts on to commemorate their contributions. But overall, it isn't there. And it's taken until, I think it's 2002 that the gates on Constitution Hill were installed commemorating the contributions Commonwealth soldiers had made to the Second World War. I mean, that's a very, very long time to wait for some form of acknowledgement. And that's why, you know, this big question about individual commemoration and collective memorialization, I think, is a very important one that I think Britain needs to address, especially now that it's become so much more diverse as a country. I mean, even before it should have done. Mm. But I think that the issue is even more pressing, that these stories get told. And you've got other examples with the MOD actually very much jumping on this because they need to be seen as being an equal opportunities employer. Mm. So they are actually creating, they've got two exhibitions. One is now at RAF Cosfield on Commonwealth Pilots, which is a permanent exhibition there. And another one is an MOD exhibition called We Were There, which was sort of very controversially hosted over at SOAS, but that's a big touring exhibition that, again, goes for individuals rather than the collective Indian Army or Navy or Indian Air Force, and tries to highlight actually what individuals have contributed. But again, there's a distinct propaganda purpose behind that. And I think that there's a very difficult balancing act, I think, to go from. Shantanu.
Sorry, I missed the last part of the paper, but I really enjoyed it, particularly the way you brought up the discrimination between the Africans and the Indians. That is kind of blind spot. Historians often don't look at it, they go on about Indians were mistreated, not ignoring that kind of much worse treatment. I have three questions. The first two more kind of specific questions. Do you come across instances of Indians being burned, corpses being burned in Mesopotamia? Just a point of interest of Hindu sepoys being cremated, in Mesopotamia. Were there any cremation rites? That's the first thing. The second thing, when you mentioned the West Indian troops, I guess I didn't really catch what you said. Were there individual names on their... So I was wondering whether race or religion, which is the issue, because with the Africans often it's the religion, that's the issue, because if they were Christians or converted, then they were the names. Whereas with the Indians, even if they were Hindus or Muslims, that's when race came in, kicked in, because they would be, you know, they would have tombstones. And the third is a kind of general and open question. I was wondering that whether it is possible to compare this process of commemoration in Mesopotamia and France and England with that in India of some previous war, because I wonder whether in an Indian conflict any of the sepoys would have much better treatment at the hands of the Maharajas or whatever. And I think that is quite interesting, because of course, I mean, it is a terrible thing that their names haven't been there, but we often forget that. I don't think they would have had a better treatment in the hands of the Indian rulers in pre-colonial India. And I think that is also an interesting point of comparison. And at least there are kind of 6,000 or whatever others. I wonder even that we would have been mentioned in some native conflict. I wonder about the Afghan war, the other wars. I know that the third Afghan war is commemoration in the India Gate in Delhi, but I haven't really come across any commemoration sites in India at all. So we had all these Mughal wars and everything. What happened to the soldiers? We just don't know.
Well, that's why I sort of said at the beginning, I think I find it incredulous that they expect us to believe that there would be equality of treatment in 1918 when, I mean, exactly as you say, you wouldn't necessarily expect better treatment in India. You wouldn't necessarily expect better treatment in all kinds of places. And so it just seems to me to be sort of slightly... I've got very critical of the War Graves Commission in their presentation of this issue. I think that it just seems obvious to me that there would be discriminations taking place in that period. That it's probably obvious now, but it certainly would be obvious then. And so I think it's slightly insulting our intelligence to try and present this account of their history as having been egalitarian in this regard. So I hope I don't come over as sort of too indignant about what they actually did. I mean, I think what they did was completely understandable. I think the point where I'm indignant is the way the present War Graves Commission is trying to pretend that... I just think it's bizarre. And I think it's going to be fascinating. They might be able to put up a memorial in Hong Kong in which they've newly carved the names of 941... Chinese who died in the First World War. I mean, that it does seem a slightly odd thing to do, but are they really going to put up something in, you know, Surrey or Iraq with 33,000 newly carved names? It just seems extraordinary that they're thinking of doing that and sort of trying to occlude the fact that this is a new development. So I don't think it's... I don't think what they did was... any worse at all. And as far as race and religion is concerned, I don't know how I would answer that, because I think that as far as I can see, that in the African context, they are massively privileging anything that they relate to as Christian. That's basically what they're saying. And they're saying the West Indians are Christians, and so they're going to be treated. The European Cape Boys are Christians, and so they're going to be treated differently. My impression is, I'm just trying to think while I'm talking, because I have looked at various other places as well. I'm just trying to think how it figures in other places, but I think that they're operating with both of them. And so in all the African material that I've looked at, the reason I say race is because they operated with such a strong distinction between whites and natives. And I mean, you know, just to sort of underline a point I made in the talk, the whites include the Germans. So I've got, I could read you out whole passages where they say, we've got these bodies from a particular battle, what shall we do? Oh, we'll take the white people, including the Germans, and bury them properly with nice headstones and everything. And all the black people, even if they're fighting for us, their graves can revert to nature. And we'll put their names on the registers of memorials to the missing, which in Africa don't have names on them. So that means absolutely the black Africans who are fighting with you are nothing is to happen, and the Germans that you're fighting against, you are to commemorate solemnly in perpetuity. And that, I mean, that, you know, seems to me to be an issue where one would say that race is predominating. But obviously in some of the others, religion is predominating. I know you are. I'm racking my brains while I'm talking to you because. Oh well, of course, yes. I mean, in the, you know, they set up. I'm eyeballing Nadia to see if she's going to say anything, but yes, you know, they had proper burning guts in Pycombe near Brighton, where they did cremate the Indian soldiers who died in the hospital in the pavilion. But I don't know. I mean, mainly, I suppose, because I've been... I mean, I can think of lots of examples where they're talking about the wrong people being buried in the wrong cemeteries in Mesopotamia. But have I read anything about actual cremations? I'm not sure that I have. Oh, yes, 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 absolutely. I can give you lots of examples of Hindus accidentally being buried or... And I did read, I don't know if you were here, I read out this one quotation where they said, they basically said, if you have a situation where either people have been buried and they shouldn't have been, or people have been buried with other people and they shouldn't have been, you have to, the first decision you have to take is, what am I going to ignore? And so they quite deliberately decide just to ignore some of them.
Got time for one last question, please.
How the ground is being, obscured and covered. You know, and covered. Mm. I mean, in some ways, that's politically the most interesting thing. But of course, as a 19th century person, I'm also thinking back to think whether there are any tentative links we can see from the history of colonial slavery and of the Seaford Rebellion and so forth in these differential treatments. I know, obviously, these heavily mediated and involves a huge number of a complex ways in which Britain did and didn't wasn't interested in India as a culture in its own right, and ways it definitely wasn't that much interested in Africa in the same kinds of ways. But it's so, I mean, I just, so I mean, I'm not offering any sort of off the cuff analysis, but it got me thinking about that, because this sort of elaborate attention to the sepoys. If you've been reading what are now current debates about how we should now think about, colonialism and the Indian Mutiny and the sepoy rebellion, and how should we should call it, which is still hot under being contested. And I think to think of that and this much more, elaborate. Recognition at some level, if not, of the sepoys is interesting. And the other part of that is as if it's as if converting in Africa and in the West Indies, what people thinking of in what still seems to be much more Christian nation than we sometimes acknowledge around the First World War, is that conversion to Christianity is one of the successes of colonialism, and therefore we should see these people as subjects in the same way as we see Europeans. So, I mean, I just wonder whether it's worth or whether you think it's even interesting to try to make, you know, track those things through in any way. I'm not sure even how you would do it. And the other thing, I suppose, is the last one, which is about how, you know, that whole idea about subjectivity and how it extends past people's death, what questions of family, you know, are recognized. And it's really rather subtle differentiation. One has, they're crude at one level, but they're subtle at another, which involves, as you say, both rank, race, ethnicity, and who looks. You know, who looks. I just think that's so, that's so gripping, and whether, you know, again, that is a kind of legacy of racial theories and racial thinking that is still very much alive at the time of the, you know, there's the war and between the wars, and only begins to be really challenged after World War II. And I just wonder whether you know, whether you think those are routes that are worth going down, or
yes, definitely. I mean, I suppose I think that the I suppose I think that the way in which we look at the history of the War Graves Commission is so dominated by their account of themselves, and what they were about was, oh, you know, the Battle of Waterloo, at the end of the Battle of Waterloo, you know, they just dig great pits, and people come and take the bodies of the officers away, and their wives take them away, but other than that, they chuck in the men who are fighting on each side, and they chuck in the horses and so on. And it's, you know, it was also completely barbaric. And look, we're in this kind of nirvana of progressiveness and radical kind of individualized democracy. And, you know, they've told that story so incredibly efficiently that it's sort of difficult to break past it. But, I think that is, would be really interesting to sort of connect it up with the kinds of issues you are raising. I mean, the other thing I was just thinking while you were talking about Christianity, as I did read a book whose title eludes me at the moment, which was about a sort of Christian missionary station in East Africa. And one of the stories that it was told there was that there were lots of local people who they had converted to Christianity. And then when the war sort of got going in East Africa, and the military people would come round looking for recruits, they all said, oh, no, you know, we're much more likely to get conscripted if we're Christians in Western dress. And so they flocked away from the churches and sort of took their Western clothes off and put their loincloths back on again and said, oh, no, you know, we're pagans kind of thing. You don't want us in your army. And I thought it was completely fascinating that, that's just sort of one anecdote about the thing about Christianity.
It was part of the political agenda that Indian leaders, they wanted to take part in the war, because partly because they wanted to use it as a lever for independence, but also to prove that they were not cowards or destroyed.
Yes,
very much part of that
Absolutely.
Discourse at that time. And the second thing about subjectivity, you said that race is partly because I think most Indian academics were middle class, whereas the sepoys who came, they were working class. I think we haven't yet reached a stage like Ireland, where there are working class Indian scholars who want to trace back their roots. So as a result, it gets not looked at as much as in West Indies or in Ireland. It's a class thing that's going on now, I think.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Please join me again in thanking Michelle for a great paper with lots of food for thought. And I've just got briefly two more announcements to make. Jacqueline Jenkinson's paper, The Role of South Asian Sailors in the 1919 Port Riots, has been rescheduled for Tuesday, the 5th of May. So, and that will happen here at the IES as well. It would be great if you could join us then. And then we have got a forthcoming workshop on the 14th of July, Muslims Making Britain, which is going to happen at SOAS. And again, we'll be sending out more information as it becomes available, and it'd be great if you could come and join us for those events as well. Thank you very much.